Celtic Stuff Live, the only toll-free call-in webcast produced specifically for Celtics fans. With your hosts, Jughead, JB, and the Duke. Celtic Stuff Live. And now, Jughead, JB, and the Duke.
Welcome to Celtic Stuff Live. How you guys doing?
Hey, great, Jughead. How you doing?
Doing pretty good.
Yeah, I like that intro, you know, the putting in the Jefferson quote. You know, I was wondering this week, did you and I exchange emails on when Howard got signed, whether Jefferson was going to be asking for that kind of money?
What?
No.
I think the answer is no, JB.
Okay, well, Dwight Howard was signed, I don't know, it was $80 million for 5 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I told you, JB, I was gone all weekend, but I appreciate you setting me up.
How much less can Jefferson ask for, and how much will the Celtics pay him? And are we going to
wait? So, what was the give me the terms of the contract before we roll right into it? $80 million, you said, for how many years?
5 years. That's what I remember.
So $16 million a year.
Does that sound right to you, John?
Well, I heard that they had come to an agreement, but that nothing would be signed until after the July, whatever date. It's, you know, agree in principle, basically. And I think that, if it's $80 million 5 years, I mean, I didn't hear what the terms were either, JB, so unfortunately I'm leaving you high and dry on that. But to your larger point, you know, I think that while we all see, you know, we've been tantalized by some pretty incredible play by Al Jefferson, I think that even Al knows that he wants to stay here, and he's talked about it a lot, that he wants to be here. I think the Celtics would go to just about any length to sign him, if that means a max deal, but I don't think they're going to advertise it. And I think that, giving Dwight Howard a max deal when, you know, the guy who was picked 14 spots after him may be a better player next year, that's, I don't know. I don't know if I would go with a max fruit if I was, you know, Orlando. I would think he's still just a notch below there with Jefferson, but. What do I know? Of course, the Magic are about to fire Brian Hill, too. So who knows what they're doing down there?
Yeah, I don't see him every day. Look, at his age, the way he can keep improving, it's hard to question not letting him go. As you said, the Celtics are attached to Jefferson. They probably wouldn't give him, you know, a max or close to it as well, whereas maybe fans in a whole lot of other cities would say, you know, hey, besides a 20-game stretch, what's he done? You know, can he stay healthy, et cetera, et cetera. So, we're probably, I don't know if we're talking in that ballpark. That's why I brought it up. Up to now, we've been thinking $10 million.
That's interesting. It is really interesting, and I'm sorry I missed it this weekend because I wish I was more prepared, you know, with my thoughts on this. But, you know, I have to think that it definitely drives up the price for Jefferson. I mean, yeah, I've been thinking $10 million myself. And, Mike Gorman thinks, you know, he said that he thinks Jefferson will be better than Howard or as good. And, you know, I think offense is maybe a little bit, you know, harder to teach in some aspects. But, you know, Dwight Howard had an impact the minute he came into the league on his team. And Jefferson, while he had some impact there at the second half of, his rookie year, he really started to shine. Obviously he struggled last season. So, I mean, it's going to come down from that. And I don't think the expectations for Al Jefferson put him up in the $16 million range. But it might bump him from $10 to $12 million a year, don't you think?
Well, I just don't know. It's almost hard to imagine who's his agent, all those kinds of things.
We'll have to get Eric Weiss's thoughts on this he knows some of the agents and stuff like that. I wonder if, for those of you just joining us now on the show, Eric Weiss is going to be with us. John, is he coming on at 7:15? Do you know?
That was the time we talked about last week.
Okay, that's what I thought. All right, perfect.
Yeah.
All right, so Eric Weiss will be joining us. We'll be talking a little bit about the draft. We got some emails and some posts or some comments on the show announcement from Darren. So be sure to ask Eric those questions as well. You know, it's pretty quiet on the Celtics front this week. You know, there's not a whole lot, not a whole lot going on. Obviously, you don't expect it to. Everybody's kind of on cruise control till May 22nd. But I thought Jessica Camaretto had a nice article. I don't know if you guys want to break that down now or wait a little bit, but I thought there were some interesting nuggets of information in there.
Did you get? Yeah, I think we should get into that now. I mean, obviously, I think, you know, Eric has a, you know, you and Eric spend a great deal of time in the locker room, and you have some insights, I think, probably that most of us don't see because we aren't able to enter past the velvet rope, you know, and get back there and see these guys more in their natural element. But I thought it was a great piece by Jess. I emailed her this week and thanked her for sending a copy of it because I think one thing that and Eric talks about this a lot, and that's why I'm hoping we can get into it a little bit early now and see Eric's take on some of those comments, is that, you know, so much of basketball, the NBA, is the team concept. It's how well do guys fit in, how well do they work together, you know, what are the cliques, are there any cliques, do they get along? And you hope, you know, you'd like to say that's not the case. They're all professionals. But let's be honest. We have a team of 22, 23, and 24-year-olds that generally seem to like each other quite a bit. There's a lot of names on that list that came up, you know, at different times. You'd see Tony Allen. You see, you know, Delonte West, Al Jefferson, Kendrick Perkins. They all seem to, you know, Paul Pierce. The people that, as a Celtics fan, I would want to see on that list as people who, you know, in that locker room, people are talking about and appreciate their game, appreciate their efforts, that we're seeing those and the players are responding in kind, I think is a good sign and reflective of the fact that these guys get along, they like playing with each other, and they like to, they see themselves growing with each other and growing as a team. And I think that's a really important concept. And I'm sure Eric talks quite a bit about this, but I thought it was really enlightening, and some of the choices were particularly noteworthy. Of course, the omission of Sebastian Telfair entirely, I thought, was noteworthy as well. But
well, if you read it, you can almost pull out the core, you know, like the players that really stick together. You know, you just look at who comments on each other in this article, and you can really pull out, you know, the guys that are getting along really well, or you at least get some insight.
To take that a bit further, you can look at the fans' patience with the team and maybe compare it to Chicago, who somebody said that's a model, you know, for the Celtics developing young players for 3, 4, 5 years until they're ready and then bringing in that big free agent or two to make a run for things. And Chicago never seemed to have that luxury. Your fans turn on you, the press turns on you, maybe you start biting at each other too. Interesting. I wonder how much of a factor that is.
That's an interesting point.
That is a good point, JB.
Yeah. I want to chew on it now.
Yeah, I know.
Speechless. Hey,
I don't have an initial reaction. I really want to think about
that. It is unusual, isn't it? And they do seem like a nice bunch of kids too. You know, honestly, they really do seem like they're polite and, not
the type you bring home to mom, right?
Too big-headed. Yeah, you know, they brought up well or something. I don't know.
Well, one of the things I really liked about it is I felt like Tony Allen was really sticking out in a lot of the players' minds. I mean, he got mentioned for, you know, a lot of things. Like under Most Improved, you know, we only saw about a month and a half of Tony Allen, you know, or not even a month and a half, maybe a month where he really came into his own. And, Kendrick Perkins brought, you know, mentioned him as the most improved. I mean, you know, to quote Jess's article.
I read someplace that five, and I had forgotten this 100%, that five-game winning streak was when he came into the starting lineup for Zerbiak.
That's right. When Pierce was still healthy.
Yeah, well, that was the best basketball.
No, that's the good thing, right? Year. Absolutely, yeah.
His defense might have turned the season around as it did in his rookie year. Wasn't the insertion of him in the starting lineup the one that maybe saved that season and took us to the playoffs?
You have to think so. I mean, his defense was huge, and he was
not just single one thing, but people mentioned it. both times.
I think a lot of people singled that out as the reason that, I mean, you know, there were some trades and whatever, but I think a lot of people singled out, you know, Tony Allen putting them back on the map. I mean,
and how often have we talked about having that guy across from Paul Pierce to lock down the other team's best scorer? I mean, and Tony does it. I mean, I think that's that point gets, you know, was overstated a bit maybe when before Tony, you know, 2003, you know, that kind of post Antoine era, right after the 2002, it seemed like everyone was talking about the idea, well, we got to have somebody on the opposite wing, and Tony was hit or miss. But I think that's true, JB. His presence does something that nobody else on that team, you know, can duplicate, and lots lock down the other best player on the opposite team, and you know now that he's been able to get some of the, I don't know, hitches in his game, the, you know, got to take 50 dribbles to get to the basket and the,
well, the world. Not, I don't know if stuff. That's fair, John. I think it's the balance of his outside shot and having the lift to go hard enough to the hoop so that he doesn't get swarmed in mid-flight. I think that was so much the difference when he could take off from a distance away and get elevated to come down and slam it. It was a whole lot different than when he was trying to dribble in close to the hoop so he could throw one up. It was his lift came back, I think, and hitting that jumper. I mean, he became an impossible guard. Like you could picture Gerald Green on his best day.
Yeah, but it was his. I mean, he was turning over the ball over a tremendous amount before.
But I think that was before his lift came back, and he was trying to dribble it through.
Well, yeah, I suppose that's. You know, I would consider it as it was poor decision making.
Well, same thing that happens to Pierce when he decides that, you know, I want to score now or I need to score now, whatever it is. And
yeah. But he's not Paul Pierce.
When he had that lift, he could get up there and get away with that move.
True, that's true. But he's never been the Paul Pierce type scorer, and he's never been able to duplicate that. I mean, he's been a good scorer, but I mean, not that, you know, level.
And prolific.
I think he looked like a great, you know, complimentary player. But he's never going to be the guy, you know, the guy in an offense. And I hope, you know, and certainly, you know, there was a little bit of rust, I think, there starting the season. But, you know, he shook it off. And, you know, sadly, it just ended all too quickly for him. But he's going to have a summer to get back. And I think probably it's going to be another rusty first couple of months for him, too, which is too bad. But, you know. I think it will give him some growth in his game, you know, intellectually, which are where I want to see him grow more than any other part.
Talk about the triangle. If we had him and Rondo and Oden in the middle, what a defense that would be on the floor. You know, if we could get Jefferson and Pierce healthy on the wings, but, you know, wish is as good as miles, is that what they say?
Well, I, you know, in the vein on the Tony Allen thing, I just want to quote one of the quotes in Jess's article from Delonte West, in asking who is the biggest motivator. So, you know, not only, you know, the most improved, but under biggest motivator, you got a vote from Delonte West. Delonte says, "I say Tony Allen. He's such an interesting character. He brings so much to the locker room. It's tough on those, and then there's ... games when he's not in there bringing his energy and personality. Guys tend to follow along. It's tough not having him around." And that's what we kind of felt during that five-game stretch and everything just before his knee went down. He was like the last guy who was, you know, really fighting, and he was bringing so much energy to the team. You know, it's gonna be interesting to see how quickly he comes back this year, especially – you know, when we see who they wind up getting in the draft, you know, because a lot of people say if they wind up picking Kevin Durant, that Durant's not ready to play the four, that he'd have to play the three. And, you know, can you take a number two guy this year and then bury him on the bench or even have him the first guy off the bench? I mean, that's going to be, you know, it's going to be tough for some of these guys if they do pick Durant and he has to play the three.
Yeah, look, who knows? It's a bridge they'll cross. Hard to speculate on what's gonna, right, John?
Yeah, I'm afraid even. It's funny because it's funny you said it that way, JB. Because every time now, as we're getting closer and closer, my level of superstition is getting absurd. I'm now taking to wearing the same Celtics hat every day. I've worn the same hat now since the season ended. I'm wearing green shirts every time basically every Tuesday. So that way I have, you know, I'm ready. I have issues, guys. And today, I had Chinese food today. Open up the fortune cookie and it says, great news will be coming from far away. I think Secaucus is pretty far away from Maine, guys. That's all I'm saying. You know, just throwing it out there. So, you know, superstition.
Now, look, Sean, if that fortune cookie had said, hey, John Ling was going to be a Celtic, then I'd say you have something here. You're kind of treading water on this topic. You haven't got me convinced yet. But you better write all this stuff down just in case. If you're right, you'll know what to wear next time. Or if you're wrong, you'll know what not to wear, right?
And you realize that you have to wear them in the exact same order that you wore them this time. So you better start taking notes. I mean, what, you're 2 weeks into this?
Yeah, that's right. It's a commitment to excellence, gentlemen. That's what it is. And, you know, if we want to excel, that's what we're going to have to. Not that we're excelling now, certainly.
You better ban him from next week's show, Jug, until the lottery's over.
Well, I don't care which one it is. Just look at it this way, JB. Whether or not they take Durant or not, if they have the opportunity to take, they have the choice. That's what's all you want. You want to have the ability to make the choice. You know, I'll quibble about who it is, you know, after the 22nd and the night of our show that night. We'll I'd love to have that opportunity, but I'm afraid at this point to get too far down that road.
Well, they announced the Summer League teams out in Vegas and the dates of Summer League, if you didn't know.
I did. I noticed the Chinese national team was one of the, you know, participating teams, which is something different than I've ever seen. I'd never seen a non-NBA team entered.
Not that I know of either. There'll be 20 teams, I guess, too. It's a pretty big league.
And typically they have, it seems, you know, between, you know, maybe 8 and 10 teams. This year it's just become a monster. And I mean, that's great. I just hope that they have the TV coverage to back that up. Last year, you know, if you didn't have NBA TV, you'd have to wait three weeks before it came on. It was a big complaint of mine, and I don't know why the league hasn't fixed that. There's so much interest in how these players play and the young guys. You know, for a lot of teams that, like the Celtics, are not watching basketball. You know, Celtics fans aren't watching basketball right now. They're waiting for the draft, and they're waiting to see their young players, and it's awfully hard to make them wait until October. So it sure would be nice to get a glimpse of them early. When it comes up in July, so
yeah, that's a good point, Sean, about the coverage. And there was an article in I think it was the Globe today about how the PR people are kind of licking their chops over this draft and Oden and Durant, and you know what it might mean for the Celtics' fortunes in terms of how many times they're on TV, etc., etc. Wonder if it'll have any impact on Summer League. And how many games are shown back here? Whether is it just Fox or that decides not to go down there, or is it NBA TV that won't release it?
Well, I think it's the NBA wants to keep a close hold on that, but it seems to me that in the past that their approach was very lackadaisical, and you're almost supposed to be lucky that you're seeing this footage
a week late,
right?
Three of the games maybe out of order.
Right.
Yeah.
And I know Fox, when the league was in Boston, when it was the Shaw Summer League, that Fox broadcasted a few of the games, and Mike and Tommy, you know, admittedly it wasn't, you know, professional. You know, they tried to do the best they could with it, but it was nice to see that. And when it went out west, obviously, so it costs a lot of money to fly those guys out there for 2 weeks, to do the show. But the NBA, I think, is taking the reins of that and, you know, has a tight fist on when they show those games. And it just seems unbelievable to me that they can't just, you know, broadcast them back live. I mean, what else are they going to show? Are they going to show, you know, the 1 millionth airing of Sweet 16, the 85-86 Celtic Championship, which is a great one anyway. But, you know, I mean, what really do they have of, you know, pressing news on NBA TV when it comes to mid-July?
always seemed crazy to me. They have all the young stars there to promote, many of them, you know, before people know whether they're going to be stars or not. So, you know, there's just tremendous amount of publicity potential as far as I was concerned. And we know what the interest is because people die. You know, somebody finds a column by somebody who's there and it gets passed around the internet within a half an hour, 100,000 people have read it.
Yeah, it stinks when, you know, the games happen and then you get all the reports about all the highlights and everything and, you know, then you watch it a week later. It just loses too much of its interest. To be honest with you, I rarely watch any. I just wait for somebody to filter it out onto YouTube and, you know, give me the clips that are noteworthy that I already read about. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, that was awesome. And, you know, we're going to have to get one of us to fly out there. We'll have to do a fundraiser over the summer. And, you know, you can bring your cell phone and get the video clips and send them back, and we'll put them up on the site or something.
Yeah, that'd be fun. I, one of these years, maybe we'll all three of us go down after we get our 30th or 40th sponsor.
Yeah, that's right. We're gonna need a few sponsors. Hey, we're gonna go to the break. Now it comes to mind, you know, that maybe Eric Weiss wanted to come on the second time slot. So I'm gonna go call him and double check. And when we come back, we'll be taking some phone calls, or we'll be talking with Eric Weiss about the draft. We've got getting closer and closer. So hopefully he'll have some insight. I know some of the camps are getting underway and stuff, and I think he's attended a few of those. So looking forward to hearing what he has to say about that.
Celtic Stuff Live is brought to you by Garber Family Dentistry in Salem, Mass. Garber Family Dentistry is a practice that treats both children and adults using modern equipment. That includes intraoral cameras so that you can see what they see, and digital radiography. That's 90% less radiation than conventional x-rays. They also use sedation for people who experience anxiety during dental procedures. That's Garber Family Dentistry. Give them a call, 978-744-8495.
$1,000,000. Thank you. Bidder number 225.
Allen Auction Company, specializing in distinctive properties and municipal auction services. Using innovative sales and marketing strategies, they ensure that the auction day experience is both positive and profitable. Visit their website, allenauction.com, or call 781-592-8100.
Great stuff. Great stuff. So, JB Hannibal. I love it. I love the A-team, guys. There's nothing wrong with the A-team. You know, we could use an A-team here in Boston. You know, we need a unit of players that can go by the A-team. It's nothing. I love the A-team, you know? They could do one of those old six-pack T-shirts they used to have back in the 80s where you had the six best players on the team. Except we'd have, like, the A-team van and have, like, the six heads sticking out of it. That'd be great, guys, right?
Hey, I'm all for it.
Why not?
How about the hit team? Did you read Mark Murphy's article today called Green with Envy? And it's about four paragraphs telling us all about Ainge having not passed up on Roy. For taking Sebastian, you know, it's just such a an odd article to be like your whole article for the day. I mean, it is a self-contained article. It's not an excerpt. That's all he talks about. Never mentions the $15 million that we saved that we would have to pay Jefferson without going over the luxury tax as a possible mitigating circumstance. You know, I just wonder, is the word out on Ainge now? Are they kicking him while he's down? Some kind of a little war between he and Doc? What do you think's going on?
Well, I don't know, but, I mean, Brandon Roy just got the Rookie of the Year. So, you know, I think it's a quiet time, and it's definitely an angle. You know, and there are plenty of ways to – you know, to shed money as well. I mean, you can look at this a number of different ways. I mean, I do think that it's worth mentioning obviously, you know, the fact that the money was a major part of the deal. I mean, Gorman told us that, or
well,
at least
he
alluded to it. Right. I mean, they had to do something.
He might not have taken Telfair if he knew he was going to get Rondo, you know, with 21. I mean, sure.
Well, but, you know, and let's also keep in mind the fact that, you know, maybe people weren't so concerned about the money, but JB brought on, you know, brought up at the top of the show, you know, Dwight Howard's contract, and what does that mean for Al Jefferson? You know, I don't ever see this team not re-signing Al Jefferson to a second contract. You know, they weren't going to just let him go. They would have signed him, but there obviously there could have been consequences if Al does, you know, command a decent amount of money. I mean, it would be stupid for this team, you know, to go into Al's final year and let him, you know, get to an open bidding war next summer. I mean, I think everybody knows that's all, he's only going to cost more money next summer. So,
well, that's what we all hope. But the Howard signing is just a shot across the bow, and it raised Jefferson's asking price, I'm sure, by at least a few million dollars.
But the point is that, you know, helping get that money out of Boston sooner is going to be valuable. But at the same time, you know, if they are looking to make a deal, Ratliff's contract is the major chip. So it's going to be interesting. But, I mean, you know, it could wind up being even more important than we thought it was, you know, to shed some of that salary.
Well, they're all holding their breath, because if they don't get one of the top two picks, they're going to have to make some kind of a trade. And I don't know that they're going to take a big gulp before they trade Ratliff's contract for somebody with a 3-year or longer big money deal.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, JB, because I was actually going to bring this up a little bit later, but since you did now, hey, why not, guys, right? Jeff on Thursday, our buddy over at Celtics Blog, Jeff Clark, had a post on the old C blog called Theory Challenge, Trading Theo, where Jeff took the salary commitments. He took I think he took an Excel spreadsheet. It looks like Excel. Anyway, and he what he did was he guessed. He took a rough guesstimate of what he thought, you know, players would be re-signed for this summer. He figured in that Jefferson, West, and Gomes would be re-signed, as well as a high, you know, high salaried first round pick. And then what he did was he figured out, you know, is it possible? Can you move Theo Ratliff, and still stay out of luxury tax land? And basically, you know, his finding was is that Theo for a new player would put you at $81 million, which is well above the luxury tax, and I think in an area that I don't think Wick Grosbeck is willing to spend without knowing that this is going to be a winning team. But then later on, at the end of the article, Jeff, you know, includes two guys in Ryan Gomes and Delonte West in the trade, and comes in with a figure of $71 million. So in the end, Jeff's, you know, theory is that they could use Theo Ratliff and those two guys that you happen to love so much, JB, or at least one of them that you love so much, in a deal. And, you know, roughly you'd be at $71.6 million. The only problem with that, in my mind, is that he also has Al Jefferson down for $9 million, $10 million, and $11 million the next 3 years, which if Dwight Howard's contract is any sign of things to come, that may be $1-3 million too low. So I thought that was an excellent piece, and it really addresses that point and says, you know, Theo still is a value, but the problem is that you're going to have to include guys like Gomes and West, who are probably your most ready players to play and to support, you know, that player you bring in. And the other thing is, and I just want to add this quickly on to what we were talking about to Brandon Roy, was there anybody who didn't think he'd be Rookie of the Year after this year? I mean, last year at this time? Because I thought the general consensus was everyone knew that would be probably what would happen. So I don't get the all this indignation about the fact that the guy is played well. We all knew he was a good player. So what? I mean,
it was a strange little article. It's a strange article from Murphy. I mean, it really, kick him in the ass when he's down. He tagged it onto the Telfair incident.
Well, people are still making the Randy Foy, Brandon Roy mistake, too, because I still see articles from the national media claiming that we could have had Randy Foy at number 7. And, it's simply not the case. The T-Wolves just swapped those picks to, save some salary. But it's just amazing to me. I mean, I didn't even bother. I'm just done calling these people out for that. It's just it's an attention to detail that you can't expect from some writers, I guess. But, fact that this
you just segued, or yeah, I guess that's the right word. Segued into the next topic, maybe. John's friend Peter May.
Yeah, we got an email from John JS33. You know him as Stephen B. Smith in the pit tonight. he always comes in with a different moniker when he's in the pit. But he did send us in a question, and it's regarding the Peter May column. I think we're just going to give John a 2-minute tirade and let him have at it. The question is, please ask Duke what he thinks about Peter May's trade proposal in today's Globe: Bynum, Walton, and Odom for Bassey and Pablo. All right, John, get ready.
2-minute tirade.
So, okay, Peter May, that seared of seers, prognosticator of prognosticators, has decided that the Celtics might want to take a look at trading Paul Pierce, max contract player, captain, among the team leaders in career points scored, having gone through several years of terrible, terrible teams that are not entirely his fault, but nevertheless, he's been on the team, and trade him along with the, well-packed and armed Sebastian Telfair out to the West Coast, send Paul Pierce home to L.A., in return for Lamar Odom, Bynum, and Walton. Give me a break. Are you kidding me? I've seen trades on Real GM that make more sense than that one. First of all, I haven't run it through the trade checker because I care that little about what Peter May puts together in terms of a trade package. But let me ask this. How exactly would you guys... How do you think the Los Angeles Lakers are going to feel about trading their... their star of the future, their Al Jefferson of the future, and Andrew Bynum. That's crazy. They're not going to give him up. Would you guys give away, Paul Pierce, trade for a Paul Pierce type for Al Jefferson at this point? Of course not. Of course you wouldn't. This guy's 7 foot. I think he's either 19 or just turned 20. I mean, whose earth would actually make that trade? Even, the Lakers aren't that dumb. Sure, Kobe needs people around him. But do you think he needs another, two guard who's going to take the ball and take all the shots away from Kobe? Of course not. They need a power forward. They need somebody like Kevin Garnett. Wouldn't you use all of that, all those trading chips to get Kevin Garnett instead of trying to get Paul Pierce? It's crazy. It's one of the most idiotic things I've read in the Boston Globe since Saturday. But anyway, my point is, It's ridiculous, but it's par for the course. So I guess we should be used to it. Guys, what do you think? Am I out left field here?
Eric Pincus wrote in today on the message board his reaction. That's a laugher. I can elaborate if need be, but I don't think he needs to. I think, John, you probably stated the case pretty well. This is a non-starter, except that Peter May is the topic of conversation in another media event right here and now, and perhaps many other places across the web is his name being bandied about one more time. He's the news.
Look at me. Look at me. Look at me. I've got something to say. Look at me. Give me a break. Come on, Peter.
Didn't Jughead himself do this about a year ago with a Paul Pierce trade, or a year and a half ago? He said, what if I pretended there was a Paul Pierce for so-and-so, and put it on my board, and all of a sudden everybody reacted to it? Do you remember that, Jughead?
Yeah, I don't think it was a Paul Pierce, though. I think it was, I was just getting started doing the blogging thing, and I think somebody sent me an email about Kevin Garnett, and there was no way, you know, about trading for Kevin Garnett. There was no way I could confirm it, and I put it up there anyway. And, you know, I really didn't think anybody was reading it, but it really took off. All of a sudden, I was getting 20,000 hits a day. It was something ridiculous. And I was like, well, you know, and then, you know, you live and you learn. People are like, yeah, you're going to lose your credibility if you do that. And I was like, oh, yeah, I think you're
right. Well, you put right into it and said this is an uncorroborated rumor.
I did. I mean, I clarified it.
Everybody jumped on it. There were 40,000 posts on RealGM and, you know, everywhere else. It became a hot one, and most people that were talking about it had no clue what the original source was or anything like that.
I didn't even know what the original source was. That's why I said it was uncorroborated. But still, you know, if you even insinuate anything on the internet, you have to remember it's in the summer when people are just starved for something to talk about and something to debate, and we were all, you know, I think. Early on, that was like right at the beginning of the Kevin Garnett rumors, you know, when you know, it was almost, it had finally come out that Kevin Garnett might be available. And, you know, I got an email and I put it up there, and you're right. It just took on a life of its own. It was crazy. But, you know, that is the internet. That's how it works. So since then, I've been a little bit more responsible. But, you know, even posting uncorroborated, it's got to be, you know, the source has to be close to, you know, you should always go with the unnamed source rather than here's a completely baseless, uncorroborated rumor that I'm going to post and see what happens. But
well, speaking of baseless, uncorroborated rumors, let's start one right now. Andrei Kirilenko. I saw UGA Hayes had a post in the pit, and I thought I'd bring it up to you guys. We haven't really talked about AK-47, but it's pretty obvious from anyone who watched at least the first five games of the Houston-Utah series that he's on the outs with Coach Sloan. Now, obviously, he played much better in Game 7 and played pretty well in Game 6. But I think it's pretty possible they may look to get rid of him this summer. It seems as though he's a better fit at the 4 than the 3, which is where he's been playing, but at the same time, you know, obviously, you know, he might be a tough fit in Boston because you're going to have, you know, Al Jefferson and hopefully either Oden or Durant, hopefully. But let's assume, you know, let's just assume you want to get a good player. I mean, he is a bit of a utility type player. You can fit him in a lot of different situations, and he doesn't need the ball to play, which is obviously something that you would have trouble with both Jefferson and Pierce. And for that matter, Jefferson and Pierce and Durant. It's, you know, those are the type of players the Celtics need. Guys who don't necessarily need the ball all the time, get a couple shots, you know, 5-10 shots a game. But what do you guys think about him? I mean, is he, you know, he's obviously a defensive whiz. He's the one that probably shut down McGrady the most in that fourth quarter, ensuring a Utah win.
Well, I think he's also been a much more prolific scorer in the past, and that's part of his problems here, is he's not getting shots. He's getting the ball 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times a game, and he's not happy. He doesn't feel a part of the offense. And he's complained about it, and that's probably why Sloan's not too happy with him. Very good defensive player, shot blocker. I'd want him to be happier about playing the 3 if he came here. You know, he's just a great shot blocker, a good, very good shooter, too. I mean, I think he should be getting more shots. But, you know, there's only so many to go around in Utah, too. You know, that's one problem you have when you have, you know, one guy that wants 25 shots or 30 shots. But anyway, you know, I doubt it. I would doubt that that's the kind of move that the Celtics are going to make because, you know, I don't know how many more years he's got, but there is, $12 million in salary there?
At least, yeah. He's a high-salary guy, no doubt. Yeah.
I'll look it up real quick. I'll give you guys a lowdown.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that's the biggest downside, I think, to him is that, you know, he's obviously, his production has dropped dramatically this year. He's still due for big dollars for a long-term contract. But at the same time, with Pierce, you know, with Pierce, with Jefferson, you need guys who can A, play off the ball, B, who are strong defensively, C, who can move the ball. You know, they're efficient players. They aren't
requiring of a lot of shots to get their points, could pick up, baskets off of, misses and whatnot. I mean, it just seems like that Kirilenko is the type of player that you can have fit into that. Now, one thing that I've heard from those detractors of Kirilenko's is that, even when he's been good, his production has never been the type that you pay a great deal for. He's making, and Jug will fill in the blank here, he's making, plus $12 million at least.
Yeah, this season he made almost 12.5. Next season, he's climbing to 14 almost, 13.7.
Well, he was a 15-point, 16-point-a-game scorer with 8-point-something rebounds, 3.4-point assists, 3 blocks a game, for 4 or 5 years before he got that contract. So he was a big-time player all across the board. And, there's value to a guy that can block 3 shots and average 4 assists a game, plus give you 15, 16 points and 8 rebounds. I mean, there's a guy you'd want to have. But
well, let's also... He's still young.
At 6'9", 225, I want him at the 3, and I want to make sure that he's, able to give me what he gave me the year before this. I'd want to know more about his injury and, why he took so few shots and work him out. And I don't know if I'd get our doctors, but some doctors to look at this.
Well, going right to that, JB, Would take Wally Szczerbiak, you might be able to get somebody like AK-47 for Wally because the contract length is so much shorter.
Take my wife, please.
Yeah.
Take Wally Szczerbiak, please.
There you go. Well, he's 20. Look, AK-47 is 26, so there's time for him, to resurrect his career. But he's signed at least until 2010.
It's too small to play the 4. He's got to play the 3.
Yeah, it's a big risk. Yeah, it's a huge risk financially, and I don't even know that the team has the money to do it. But I'm just saying, that's probably one way to do it, to pull in the guy. And that's how the Utah Jazz are going to be looking at it, because otherwise they're just going to be taking on a bunch of bad contracts if they move him anyway. I mean, they're pretty much stuck with his contract. They're going to look to swap him basically straight up and – this offseason's the best time to do it, because as his money climbs and climbs and climbs, because it gets way up there. It's almost $18 million in 2010, 2011. So, it's going to be a lot more, and it hits $15 million the season after next. So at that point, they start to get out of the range where they can take on a shorter, a shorter contract for similar money and an even swap. So they're going to be looking to move him this season. But we've got a caller. Welcome to Celtics Stuff Live. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. It's Alex from Celtics 24/7. How are you?
Excellent. Greetings. Welcome to the show.
How you doing, Alex?
Not bad. I just kind of had a general question, because we're talking about Kirilenko. He's kind of a small forward, power forward hybrid there. And when I look at our roster, we have, Pierce, Green, West, Allen, Gomes, and Wally. And I know you guys are going to have really diverse opinions on this, but I kind of want to hear what you guys think about. Out of those, 6 guys, who do we have to trade? Because in my opinion, I think we have to let go in the sense of, get someone back for them, at least 2 of those guys, especially if we're drafting, another shooting guard, small forward type player this year.
I'll go first.
Yeah.
I'll go first. I would give up West. I'd give up Gomes. I would try to give up Wally. And if that didn't work, then I would be willing to move someone like Ratliff to get Kirilenko. I think you have to do while those guys add to they're valuable pieces that add to a winning team, I don't think we have the core yet. And I think a guy like Kirilenko, added with Pierce, added with Jefferson, added with, maybe somebody like, God help me, Durant or Oden, you're a decent point guard away from being an Eastern Conference finalist, I believe. The problem is the point guard, and I think that, if I had my druthers, that would be where I'd target, for trade, but you got to take your all-star when they're out there, And I think that's Ainge's philosophy, is when the good players are out there, you got to go get them. And if you can get them on the cheap, relatively,
that's where you got to go. And I think a package with Weston Gomes, would be reasonable. JB? Jug?
Nope. Yeah, I'd love to have him, but if he plays the three and then you got to play Pierce at the two, you don't get to see Tony Allen and Gerald Green much, but they can move down to the three a bit, I guess, too.
I think you got to move Wally. I really do. And, maybe it costs a little bit more. Maybe it costs two instead of one of those guys. But I think it's essential that you move Wally. If you're going to take on that money, you've got to do that right away.
Yeah, I think that's the way they try to make it work.
Yeah. Do you think Wally makes it prohibitive? I guess that's the question.
Who knows? But I think we're making way too much of it because I don't think it's the kind of player the Celtics are going to target. If they're trying to make a strong move, I don't think they're going to look for a player at that position. I think we'll wait and see on the draft, but they'd have to go for a big man.
Didn't Danny always talk about having a big three and wouldn't, like you said, if Kirilenko would play the three?
I think that means moving Pierce. I really do. I don't think Pierce is their two of the future. I mean, he's got to guard some quick people out there. I think that's getting to be, less and less viable the older he gets. He's really a three.
Well, what about the caller? What are you thinking, as far as does Wally have to go in that deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think Wally has to go, but the difficulty for me is how do we trade Wally? I mean, his contract and the fact that he's been injured so many times last season is not appealing, and I really don't want to see us have to take on another big, bad contract just so we can get rid, of Wally because he plays a position where we have so many players looking to develop at. And, I mean, I'm the type I'd much rather see Gerald and Tony get playing time than Wally. If we get a Durant type who's going to play the three, I think, as much as he's going to play the four, it's difficult for me to see a scenario where a team gladly takes on Wally and his contract without us having to take on a bad deal as well. And so that's where I'm kind of on the fence. Is just I don't see, if there's a bright positive side on either side. You know what I mean?
Well, I think to answer that a bit, Alex, is that right now we are in the same shoes Portland was in a year ago. The hope is we can avoid taking on someone like Rafe LaFrance in such a deal. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You've got, basically Wally's got 2 years left. He's got this year and he's got next year. You don't want to wish the guy's going to be hurt so much that insurance would take care of his contract next year as it has this year with Theo Ratliff. But at the same time, I think that anyone who trades for Wally, they have to have a bit of a long-term in mind. They can't be, short-sighted. They can't be a type of team that's saying, well, we need, right now we need cap space. A team who's willing to take the longer view, I think that they would benefit a lot, quite a bit by trading for someone like Wally because, the guy can shoot. Say what we want about his health, the guy can flat out shoot. And he is a very, productive player for the few shots he gets. I think that a deal could be struck. I don't think we have to give up as much as you would think. But
I'll make a declaration, John. I'll make my announcement now that we'll come out of training camp next November, and two guys in our 8 or 9 man rotation will be Ratliff and Zerbiak, and we'll be glad to have them. And they'll start the season pretty well, and they'll probably play, who can know really, but I'm going to guess 40, 50, 60 games, maybe 100 games between them, and it'll be wonderful. Maybe they'll probably more likely be our veteran presence than us making the kind of trade that people are talking about.
You think Ratliff is going to play minutes next year?
Yes.
Really? You said that before this season.
Yes.
And then we're in the same scenario. I don't think he stands a chance. I think he's done. for sure. I know he says he can still play, and I think it was actually, you know, Jessica Camaretta who said that, but it's not happening. This guy's done. He might play a couple of games, but...
to me in November.
Okay, because, well, I'm going to mark this down for the second time you've made this call. So...
let me just say this about that. I hope he is gone. I hope at least one of those two are gone, because without that, we're not going to be able to move. Or we could move some of these young players, but we're not going to get the quality player in return.
Wally could
move. What we need to do is we need to thin the crop, you know, get rid of some of these players on the wing, get rid of some of the young players. Not just get rid of them, but we need to trade out young players and bring back, you know, quality, you know, veteran players.
That's been the problem all along, though, is that Ratliff's contract has Jefferson and West's name on it. And Zerbiak, nobody's going to trade for him until he plays maybe a month. I agree we could trade him maybe Thanksgiving, Christmas sometime, to a contender if he's played well through the fall. And that may be a good option for us in the fall if he's still superfluous.
Well, before we open up the phone lines again, Alex, what's your thought? Do you think Ratliff has any chance of playing any minutes next year?
Well, I mean, obviously it depends on, you know, who we draft. If we're lucky enough to get a guy like Oden, I don't see him getting any minutes. But I don't see why he couldn't still have a similar role to what we expected him to have at the start of last season, which is, you know, a guy who's going to be a sort of mentor for the big men. And that's, you know, that's what we expected from him. We expected him to teach, you know, basically Al and Perk, you know, how to play better defense, how to block shots. Except we had him as a starter for the first, you know, three or four games. I remember that when our starting lineup had Ratliff in it. And you know, I don't think it's a type of situation where he's going to start. But I wouldn't be surprised if he was capable of getting 10 to 15 minutes a game, depending on what our roster looks like at that point in terms of the five and the four position.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Alex. And keep listening and call again next show.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you, Alex.
Opening up the phone lines again. Toll-free number, it's right there on the top of the pit, 866-751-9649. You know, I think, you know, depending on the draft, there may not be any minutes at center for him. I mean, we know Doc likes to use the small lineup. Obviously, we're assuming that he's, you know, that Doc's going to be back as the coach, and I know there's some speculation as to whether or not that will be the case, but let's just assume that it is. And, you know, you've got Perkins and maybe Oden and Jefferson can slide over. There's no minutes for Ratliff if that happens.
Ratliff starts at center if Doc is still the coach. I'll make that declaration number two.
Oh, my word. All right, hold on.
Holy cow.
I'm going to get my paper.
But that was just a bad joke, Jughead.
Yeah, yeah.
You can write bad joke after that one, please.
No.
You don't want to take it out of context. Yeah,
that's all right. I'm going to save that audio file. And Well,
guys, I want to, if it's okay, I want to switch gears a little bit here. And, you know, I don't want to use all our bullets here in the first hour, but let me go ahead. There has been a lot of talk in recent days about the difficulty that that Danny Ainge has shown in making trades. And that's probably, obviously, the biggest sign of that has been the Portland trade with Roy and Telfair. But I think that the second biggest trade that has come up is actually the trade that didn't happen, and that would be the trade that didn't happen for Baron Davis. The Golden State Warriors have been playing out of their heads, knocked off the number one team in the league with 67 wins. I mean, unheard of, guys. And you know, Baron led the way. I mean, he took a team that was not good last year, and he made it that team knock off, you know, probably one of the best, you know, easily the best team in the league this year. And the Celtics ended up not pulling the trigger on that deal, and it's been rumored, and I'm not sure if it's ever been attributed, you know, to anyone, that the team was going to make the deal. Ainge liked the deal, wanted to bring Baron Davis in. He's a friend of Paul Pierce's. And ultimately the team didn't do it and ended up going for the Antoine trade instead. Because Wick wanted to have the ticket sales, and they didn't want to give up Tony Allen.
you know, this is something that, a lot of people have talked about, you know, we need a point guard. Baron Davis, you know, could be that point guard. I have a lot of questions about his ability to distribute. I think he shoots a lot for a point guard, or he's had to in the places that he's been. But the leadership that he's showing out there in Golden State, I mean, he has been the glue that has put a pretty young team, relatively, together, and obviously with some Don Nelson coaching, don't forget, made that team unbelievable to watch and very exciting. Now, do I think they can hold it up forever? No. But a guy like Baron Davis, you know, somewhat veteran savvy, some real skills out there, it sure makes you question whether or not the right decision was made that late spring, or I guess early spring day there in 2004. I just wonder what you guys' thoughts are on that, and whether or not you think...
I think it was his back problems that was scaring a lot of teams away. I mean, he was one of the premier players in the league before he started, having problems. And he missed quite a number of games this year as well. He, of course, finished strong. And interesting sidebar to this is Peter Vesey in today's post queried whether he ran into the locker room to take a painkiller of some sort in the first quarter when his thigh, the hamstring problem started to recur, and he came back out, and Peter said, you know, it was noticeable and didn't think that a little bit of massage and whatever, you know, would have had that much of an effect, and then, you know, went on to chide players for trying to mask pain to play. He said it's never a good sign, but anyway, Peter tries to make something sensational out of just about anything sometimes. But to get back to the main point, Baron, you know, looked to have a bad back, and you know, did you want Ainge to take another one that, you know, you might have to pay for three out of the last 7 years of his contract?
Yeah, you know, what has he got? He's got two more years left on his contract, right around $17 or $18 million, and it definitely was the back that was scaring everybody off. I remember wanting him at that time. I remember thinking that, you know, that would really help. And I, you know, here I am years later still, you know, wishing we had a point guard. And so, I mean, I look, guys, we're not going to get into the whole Rondo discussion yet, but I still think a vet point guard would help this team, and it definitely would have helped the last couple of years. You know,
I'll tell you something interesting. I'm just getting his stats out. This is something I would not have expected. In 2004-05, he averaged 8.3 assists. 2005-06, 8.9 assists. And this year, 8.1 assists. And it wasn't that bad. It was 7.2 and 7.5 his last 2 years in New Orleans. He had an 8.5 his last year in Charlotte. So his career average is 7.2.
I have less questions about his ability to distribute the ball than I do of Allen Iverson. Let's put it that way.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
You know, and that's really, you know, obviously this past offseason people were thinking that Allen Iverson, you know, would really help elevate this team, or at least a significant number of people did, and I wasn't against that trade. Now I question it a little bit more than I did at the time, but you know, obviously, I wouldn't have paid Al Jefferson for him. But the interesting point that John's making is that wouldn't have cost Al Jefferson. It would have cost Tony Allen to get somebody like Baron Davis. And I think everybody around the league knew Baron Davis was a damn good player. It just was perceived that he was damaged goods. Now, Danny has to make sometimes to put yourself in a position to win. You have to take on these risks. You have to, you know.
You mean like Wally Szczerbiak?
Well, that's where I'm going, JV. That's, you know what I mean. And so sometimes they don't work out in your favor, and sometimes they do. It's a calculated risk. But I think, you know, Baron Davis had been playing through pain most of his career, so it doesn't surprise me if he did, you know, go and get a painkiller or whatever. You know, that's, you know, and you know he gets the, you know, the people kind of label him as a guy that plays when he wants to play, but you have to wonder if it isn't just, you know, he plays when he's able to play, and he's not going to break his back in a meaningless game in the middle of, you know, December, you know? So I feel like sometimes you have to take those risks, and you can kind of tie this conversation to a conversation about somebody like, you know, Kirilenko, just to say that, you know, sometimes to get somewhere in this league, you have to take a real calculated risk. And, you know, that's the position that they're going to be in if they don't get one of these top two spots. I mean, I think there's a lot of good players in the draft, but there's going to be more pressure to try and grab somebody. And because of another thing John said, which is ticket sales, I think that there are a number of fringe Celtics fans that bought tickets right now, you know, towards the end of the season. But, you know, that time is sort of time limited as some of these younger players become established players in the league. And, you know, they've gotten 4 or 5 years under their belts. And, you know, people kind of start to think that they know what that player is going to be over the, you know, longevity of their career. It's not fair, but it's just what happens with some of the fringe observers of a team. And so, you know, here they're going to be in a position where they're going to want to sell tickets, and they may have to make some risky moves if they don't get one of those top two. I mean, if they get Oden or Durant, I think they're safe to say that they're going to still sell tickets, even if they're just a bubble playoff team. But if they don't get one of those two, even if they get a player who's going to be good down the line, ticket sales, you know, maybe are not in as good of a position as they would be.
Let me also add to that, you know, you look at somebody like Steven Jackson. I mean, would you have touched him with a 10-foot pole 6 months ago? I mean, that guy was radioactive. He was glowing, for crying out loud, out there in Indiana. And, you know, now he looks like, you know, he looks like he's the next, you know, Bob Ori. He's making shots all over the place. You know, there comes a point where, you know, that there's a fine line between character and between, you know, wanting to get wins and having players who are elite. I mean, Golden State players, even Baron Davis was saying, you know, we were jumping on Steven Jackson's back because he's the only guy on the team that had won a championship. It's just crazy. It's amazing how, you know, one winning series can make one team look like they're doing everything right and everything Don Nelson done is perfect. And then look on the other side, you know, 67 wins in Dallas. You know, they finally got it this year. They're playing the defense. And now people are looking like at Dirk Nowitzki that, you know, he shouldn't even show up for the press conference when he wins MVP. It's crazy. I mean, it's a very much of what have you done for me lately in the league. And it's, you know, if Dallas wants to give up on Dirk Nowitzki, I'd be glad to take him for, you know, a bag of Spaldings. You know, We lose sight of the big picture sometimes in this league, and we focus so much on what's happened, you know, right in front of us, and it's too bad. It really is.
You know, and the other thing with Golden State too is that, you know, just because they had this one round, it doesn't mean that they're not gonna that this isn't gonna fall apart on them next year. You know, this could totally implode.
Talk about losing sight of the big picture, guys. Don Nelson just splashed dirt on Mark Cuban's cape with his horse and carriage riding by. I mean, my friends, please, this was more important for Golden State, for Don Nelson, you know, for the kind of tempo and morale of NBA fandom than you think.
Well,
Golden State
it's
also a revived franchise. They don't have to win any more playoff series. I mean, they've had you know, enough glory there to wipe away quite a bit of their misery. They really enjoyed this, and you know, having the Cuban doll to stick pins into is just icing on the cake. That whole story between Nelson and Cuban is great.
Well, this ties in great with an email we got from John from Montana this week, because he pointed out another little nuance to this whole series. He had a couple of questions. I'm just going to do his first question and then a comment that he has at the end. But he said that he went on vacation to San Francisco and was able to hop over to Oakland and catch the last regular season home game for Golden State versus Dallas. And he asked, why is it that Dallas did not get flack for sitting their starting five, which essentially allowed Golden State to make the playoffs? Yes, Dallas did have the best record and the number one playoff spot wrapped up. However, one would think that this would be looked down on more than, you know, Boston sitting, you know, injured players in the hopes of getting a good draft pick. Dallas essentially gave Golden State a playoff green light, and since they never beat them during the regular season, gave them confidence to beat them in the playoffs. This is an outstanding email and a really great point. You know, when you take a look at that, you know, the final game of the season, I don't know that necessarily the league needs to put flack, but if you're, you know, if you're the Mavericks, do you really want to play Don Nelson in the first round? You know, do you I mean, you almost have to think that you would do anything to avoid that. And instead, it showed this kind of bravado that obviously was unwarranted.
I read another interpretation, and that was that Avery didn't want to risk the chance of a hooped-up Golden State team beating his starters, that it was kind of a chicken shit move, just to kind of rest everybody and come back strong for the playoffs, not risk a humiliating loss going into the playoff series.
John, what are your thoughts? I mean, how did you read into that? Because I hear what JB's saying, but at the same, obviously they didn't want Golden State to have momentum, but if they could have eliminated them, I mean, you have to take the proactive stance,
Well, that article's thrust, and I agree. Yeah. Obviously, it turned out terribly.
Yeah, that lackadaisical attitude hit them in the face.
Well, it took confidence away from his players. They may have thought, gee, the coach doesn't think we can beat this team. It takes a little life. You want to meet the challenge on the street corner. You don't want to have to walk away. You know what I'm saying? It's psychological, but may have had some impact. It may not, but he took a lot of heat for it. Now, I don't think the league took kindly to it either. Look, that impugns the integrity of the league as much or more than anything that people can say. This is an actual act favoring one team over another. And I remember the Celtics took some heat some years back. I believe it was Cleveland and New Jersey that were fighting for the last playoff spot. And our last two games were one at Cleveland, two at Jersey. And we rested our players against Cleveland and lost and then played our starters and beat Jersey to knock Jersey out of the playoffs by a game. Was that the way it went?
I can't recall, honestly.
A couple of years ago?
Only 2 years ago, guys. Yeah.
Was that the John Carroll era? I think.
Shake it up. No, I don't think so. Well,
was
maybe.
It? I think. Yeah,
you're
think
right.
That was
no,
the
I know.
John
it was,
Carroll
it was
era.
The Docker first year, right as we were entering the playoffs against Indiana.
Yes.
I remember that now. Yes, I recall that. Yep. Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's exactly how it went down. And yeah, to be honest with you guys, I think the whole, if you've made the playoffs and you rest your starters, I don't think that's a big deal. I really
but to
don't.
Do it selectively against two teams
well,
in
yeah,
the
but,
playoffs on the last two games,
yeah,
it is a big deal. Now,
yeah, but you know what? But let's be honest with you. If you can't beat a team in seven games, then you don't have.
No,
you don't
I'm not
serve.
Talking about that. I'm talking about what they did to the Clippers.
Right, but what are we talking about here? Are we talking about whether or not it impugns the quality of the playoffs? Are we talking about whether or not there's a challenge to the character of competition and wanting to play, to the last buzzer. I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand here where should I be upset?
That's why you pay your money. You pay your money to see teams competing, and there's always been an unwritten rule, I know in baseball for sure, that when you play a team in the pennant race in the last week or two, no matter where you are, you play that game to win.
Yeah, but playing to win is one thing. Resting your starters is something else. I mean, it's like the Celtics this year. They didn't play all their players necessarily when they could have played them, but they've always played to win. Those players.
Oh, come, on,
not,
John.
Not give,
come on, John.
They didn't give, less effort.
Play
you think,
to win. Look,
you think
John,
any players gave John, less effort this year?
My point is that you should treat both games equally. If you're going to play your starters in one of the games, you play them in both. If you're not going to play them in one, don't play them in the other.
I disagree with that. I just think they faulted about that.
Yeah. I'm trying to say, let's ask about the bigger picture here. Is it are we creating
what is this bigger picture thing? What?
Well, it's years ago. Who cares about 2 years ago? What I'm saying is that this year we've got Dallas who played, who didn't play their starters and allowed, that allowed Golden State to get in, right? That's what we're saying. And there's some sort of outrage because they didn't do that.
Outrage in Clipperland because the Clippers lost their shot.
They should have won more games this year. Exactly. They shouldn't have been a severe disappointment as they were. I mean, if a team wants to complain about it, they should have played better.
You guys.
If I was a fan, I'd probably be upset about it. But, the fact is how much can they really complain? If you played off the string and you win, then you probably get in. If you put your destiny in someone else's hands, it's your own fault.
You know what? If you don't play your starters in that final game to eliminate a team that's had great success then it's – that it's just bad strategy and you don't, you know, that's, sorry, tough luck, you know. And I know the fans, you feel like the fans got cheated, but do you feel like the fans got cheated in Boston? Because Paul Pierce didn't play with an oozing elbow? I mean, because it almost seems contradictory from your standpoint.
If you play Paul against Cleveland, you got to play him against Jersey in a pennant race, unless something happened to him in the Cleveland game. I mean, that's just my point. I do remember the Jersey tradition thing.
Now that they've had a second, I do remember the whole Jersey thing where, you know, it really altered the, you know, the final standings.
Same exact situation as with the Clippers and Golden State. They had two games left, one with the Clippers, one with Golden State, and they affected the outcome by beating the Clippers and then not playing their starters and losing to Golden State. That's how it happened.
Yeah, but that's just the way the league goes down the stretch. I mean, it just is. And I think teams should have a right to rest their starters heading into the playoffs. I just think it was an absolutely mindless maneuver on the part of the Mavs. You know, I just think they were only thinking one way about this. They were thinking, we have to rest our starters. Everybody else rests their starters, and we're about to go to battle, and it's been a long season, and, you know, if we can give these guys, you know, a game of rest, then we're going to, you know. But they made a major error when they did that. And they didn't necessarily, they could have rested a couple of players. They could have played reduced minutes if they had the game in hand. I mean, there's a lot of ways that they could have approached this game where, you know, they still could have had a chance to win it strategically without, you know, draining their starters before the playoffs. I mean, you know, it's not really even that black and white of an issue. There's a gray area there, which is to say that, you know, why not just reduce the minutes? See if you can run out to an early lead and run with it, you know. But they didn't, you know, they just sat them. So, I'm not, you know, that's the way it is. We got a call. Welcome to Celtic Stuff Live. You're on the air.
Hey, guys, what's up? It's Eric.
Hey, Eric, what's happening? You ready to join us? We're gonna have to take a commercial break, but if you wanna join the show, you're more than welcome if you're ready.
Yeah, I am now. I apologize for my absentness. I'm lost in Monterey somewhere. So
that's better than in Lost in the Rain in Juarez, huh?
Yeah, probably. I was substantially better. If you knew where I was, being lost isn't so such a bad thing.
Well, Monterey, I've heard it's a beautiful place. Sure.
JV, have you been to Juarez?
No.
I have, and there's a lot of validity to that. But let's take our commercial break, and then we'll come back, and we won't have to interrupt Eric's segment, you know, while we have him on the show. So we'll be right back. We're just
going
to go.
Before you go, check out your picture on the promo on our website. Did you see it?
No, you found a picture of me?
Well, it's a picture of Harry Houdini, but go take a look.
Oh, okay. I was like, that would be tragic.
No. Take a look. Go ahead, Chuck.
All right, we'll be right back after this. Of course, I have the 30-second cue music going. We'll just go right to
stretch,
the break.
Stretch.
No, we're going to go right to the ad. We'll be right back after this.
Celtic Stuff Live is brought to you by Garber Family Dentistry in Salem, Mass. Garber Family Dentistry is a practice that treats both children and adults using modern equipment. That includes intraoral cameras so that you can see what they see, and digital radiography. That's 90% less radiation than conventional x-rays. They also use sedation for people who experience anxiety during dental procedures. That's Garber Family Dentistry. Give them a call, 978-744-8495.
Sold a million one. Thank you. Bidder number 225.
Allen Auction Company, specializing in distinctive properties and municipal auction services. Using innovative sales and marketing strategies, they ensure that the auction day experience is both positive and profitable. Visit their website, allenauction.com, or call 781-592-8100.
So welcome back to Monterey Vice. So if you're lost in the middle of Monterey, Eric, can you get internet where you are right now?
That's a different voice.
probably having a hard time hearing us. Eric, are you there?
Eric, can you hear me now?
Yep. Yes. Okay. There we go.
Good. That's clear. So anyway, if you're lost in the middle of Monterey, do you have internet access right now?
I don't know. I haven't checked in a while. I actually got away. Truth be told, I didn't get lost accidentally in Monterey. I came down to Monterey with a purpose, and that was to for a little R&R for 3 days before diving into the whole trainer circuit. By the way, all you guys, JB and Duke, and I'm gonna go see Yi Jian Lin work out in LA next week.
Excellent! So, I can't wait to hear about
full report on what he's doing and what he looks like at that point.
Excellent.
Yep. So, well, how are you guys?
Well, we're wondering where to start on this. Should we go right to the meat and potatoes thing? Mark Gasol, Draft Express picks as Boston's possible second round pick. What do you know about Mark?
Well, right now, if you read the top of the of Draft Express's board, we haven't put on team need yet. We just kind of all that thing reflects is where the buzz is and our best case scenario in terms of what we've heard and how we rank the players on a pure skill standpoint. So team needs haven't been taken into account yet. As we go through the training process and we do our finalization stuff, the last 2.5 weeks of pre-draft, we start to really start to address that, start to address the team needs, and then the order will change slightly based off of that. So Marc Gasol is he's solid. No one knows exactly how he'll translate. He's probably a good solid backup, center. He could be probably maybe a starter on a number of teams that are talent poor at center. But I don't expect him to be much more of a contributor than, let's say, a Francisco Elson or something like that, who will have some quality minutes here and there. As a smart player, will give you some. You know, I don't have to compare them athletically, but just in terms of impact, I think that it's going to. He's a subtle pro. He won't make a lot of mistakes, won't hurt you, but he's not going to, you know, take anybody to school like his brother does. So.
Well, I was half kidding when I asked about the second round pick. Okay, where do we start?
Well, actually,
then
JB,
then
hold
on. I saw it was Marc Gasol's name, and I said, gee, you know, I'd be curious to know what Eric thinks about him just because it's Powell's brother. But surely there are more compelling topics.
JB, I just want to butt in here because, you say that in jest, but we got a late email from Martin Taylor from Australia, and he actually wanted us to ask Eric who the Celtics might be looking at with the 32nd pick. So, obviously you have Marc Gasol, but, Eric, maybe list off a couple of other players that they might be considering with that selection.
It's like the whole thing I tell you all the time is there's so many permutations of what could happen depending on where their draft position is on May 22nd. It's really going to determine a lot about how they approach this draft and how they want to move things around. If we're just going to take it in the vacuum right now, I would say that I would be looking at some of those swing players. I think there's great value at the swing positions up there, and even though we have a lot of those players, being able to trade some of those guys away, which they inevitably they're going to do. They're going to move some pieces around. I'd say I look at Aaron Aufalo and I look at Dominic McGuire, and those are two guys that really stand out to me in terms of having a compelling skill set that I think can help. You know, I think those guys are surefire rotation guys. I think that Dominic McGuire could develop into something pretty nice in the future. I compare him a little bit to Gerald Wallace. I think Jeff Green's gotten a lot of respect, for being a multifaceted, multi-talented player, but I think Dominic McGuire has a lot of skill, and he really just didn't get a lot of exposure because he played down at Fresno State, so that's where I'd be looking.
Hey, Eric, is there any chance that Orlando Tucker drops that far? I mean, like there's a lot of real talented senior, guys that, in that latter half of the draft. Is there any chance he drops to 32?
Yeah, there's definitely a possibility. I mean, I don't know exactly what San Antonio is looking for. I know they've been rumored to be looking to move up, dangling a little the the rights to Louis Scola and their pick for a mid pick, so they might not be looking there, but they have been looking for an athletic swing, and I don't know how enamored they are with James White, although I got a long email from a San Antonio fan differing with me about a week ago based off my analysis. I don't think much of James White. Apparently he does. But I know they were trying to get J.R. Smith for the last like year and a half, and they've been in every rumor to try to acquire some kind of athletic wing backup guy off the bench. And you know, frankly, based off of what we get with the first pick, I was churning those channels trying to see whether or not we could throw them Gerald Green for Louis Scola in a late first round pick, because honestly, if we're going to move guys around and we need veteran leadership, I think Louis Scola is a hell of a power forward, not much of a defensive player, but just a very smart high post, low post player from Europe who's got a lot of experience. But that's just me talking. Orlando Tucker could definitely fall. He's in that range, you know, where guys start having better workouts. You know, he's not the most phenomenal shooter ever. He reminds me a lot of his predecessor at Wisconsin from about 12 years ago, I guess it is now. But Michael Finley was a very athletic, very tenacious player that hadn't exactly locked down his exterior shooting. He shot 38% as a senior, and we all know how Finley turned out. So yeah, there's a possibility, and I think he had some value because he's an aggressive player.
I was wondering, Eric, about that point guard from Finland. He's 6'5", Petteri Kaponen. Do you know the player?
I've heard his name, kind of been plunged around a little bit. I've read some of the stuff that Luis Fernandez, the guy that we have that covers EuroLeague, and I'm sure I'll get a much more in-depth report when John gets back. Most of my crew, including one of my guys from BBIQ, is in Athens right now at the EuroLeague Final Four. So I decided to lay back on this one and enjoy the sun down here on the water and before I kick off. So I have not seen him myself. I have not seen tape, and I'm going to be relying on the reporting back from Europe on that one. We'll probably follow up subsequently after that and get a better feel.
Well, he did get raves on your site. I guess he had 6 assists and 1 turnover at the games during the week in Memphis, and showed a great maturity for his age in running the team, and said he proved he has a future in the NBA, has quickness and athleticism, and his command of the pick-and-roll offense is extremely mature for a teenager. You know, it's just you don't get many real 6'5" pure point guards at that point in the second round, and I wondered with the Telfair gone whether they might look at one if he were available.
I think they'll look at a lot of players. I don't know how much they're looking to take on a kid of his age. I can't speak from perspective. I know where, for instance, I knew where Rodriguez was last year from a skill set standpoint. I knew that he could offensively impact the game on occasion. You know, he's probably a 12 to 15 game guy in terms of having a meaningful impact. And he weathered the storm and got through some of the injuries and some of the other permutations of the rotation and had an impact there. Now, you know, Roko Jukic, who spurned the Toronto Raptors a few years ago, he was, the hot commodity guy, and I watched a lot of tape on him, and I thought he could play, and he's had difficulties. His game's probably more suited for the NBA. At the same time, he had some weaknesses in his game. So if Kaponen, and that was a tall point guard, Roko is 6'7", 6'6". So, without watching film and without really seeing what their speed is, how tight their handle really is relative to the competition they'll face here, it's really tough to say, especially with a 19-year-old, how much developmental time he'll need to be able to get on the court. And the NBA has been notoriously poor at bringing players over from Europe and actually giving them a shot. Other than the top prospects that are lottery pick level guys, the NBA has been experimenting with bringing over a lot of even established players and still really not giving them a chance to do much. Other than the San Antonios and the like. There's not a lot of teams that I think are willing to let that translation period take place unless they've made a substantial commitment to a player's progress. So that hurts. Second-round guys don't have a lot of faith.
It's interesting, though, that there's more and more of the young European players and some to some degree South American players with more athleticism and quickness than we've seen in the past. And I wonder if it's whether or not that this next generation of kid is playing against world competition from a much younger age. Are they watching more film at a young age and developing? But, you know, from Leandro Barbosa right down, you mentioned Sergio Rodriguez, and now what they're saying about Kaponen, and there's a bunch of others. There's a kid from France. I'm going to wonder, his name will come to me later. You know, that are showing this great athleticism, which we haven't seen, as I said, out of the European player.
You're thinking about Batum, the kid that's got a bunch of, yeah. And I don't know what to think of him yet. There's a bunch of talent in France. I actually kind of bought the farm last World Championships because I thought France would place in the medal category because they have a lot of young talent, but their coach is one of those typical, like, play the vets a-hole guy that won't, like, he wouldn't even take Joakim Noah on the French national team because he wasn't, you know, quote-unquote a true Frenchman since he's been, like, poisoned by American influence or whatever. I thought it was crazy. So the France has a ton of young talent that's coming up. They got some seven-footers in 08, 09. They got a lot of raw talent. Batum obviously showed very well for himself when he came over here. I'm not sure exactly where his game is and how ready it is. I mean, Boris Diaw is a phenomenal talent. I can say he's the best that I've seen from that swing category in terms of the Frenchman. And when he came over, he was not able to impact the Atlanta Hawks to any great degree. Now, that could be a byproduct of the dysfunctionality of that franchise as well. But it's tough to say. There are some Europeans that are exceptionally adept, though, and ready to play. I think Thiago Splitter is a player that jumps into a rotation right away. I think Fernandez will come in, and he'll be able to get some minutes. He's a lot like kind of reminds me of Calderon. He's not a point guard. I'm not trying to make that. This guy's a pure two. But in terms of just being very savvy and very smart, not being maybe overly athletic, but just being able to make plays, set his guy up, get to where he wants, read the court, he's extremely well off. And I don't know about Yi Jian Lin. I just listened to the EEI radio interview with Danny Ainge, and he was going off about how he's played a higher level of competition. That's true. You know, the CBA, the Chinese Basketball Association, is a higher level of competition at the elite level, at that level that John Dong and the Red Army team play at. That's definitely better than the NCAA, but it's such a different way, a different style, you know, that they play. There's a huge translation process and just getting over it and having ISO sets run for you. You have much different defensive schemes. The way you run your offense is different, so... You know, there's a lot of things that go into it, and when you bring a player over from Europe,
I want to jump in here a little bit about you know, just the draft process right now, and just say, you know, I think you were already in Portsmouth, and I'd like to get some of your observations from that, and you know, just kind of outline you know, what's happening in terms of workouts and et cetera between now and the lotto. We're obviously going to have you on again. I believe we have it scheduled for the lottery night. So, you know, we'll hit up a little bit more about what's happening between then and draft night at that point. But, you know, what should people kind of be keeping their eyes out for right now? And what have you seen just since Portsmouth?
Well, in terms of the workout process, we're actually kind of at an advantage. Like I said, the league, everyone's aware of this now, I believe, but just in case anyone isn't, the league changed their structure, so there are no private workouts between players and teams until after the Orlando pre-draft. So that will be starting June 5th. The teams will have 3 weeks, essentially, or whatever that difference, 2 weeks, to, is it June 18th is the draft? No, they moved the draft back, did they not? I got to check my time schedule. But not until June 5th, the 28th. Okay, yeah. So they have 3 weeks to be able to bring these guys in and work them out. So it's really thrown the draft process on its head. because now teams are really going to have to start pinpointing and targeting the guys they want to bring in instead of kind of canvassing the league like they've done before and you know, being able to try out second-round picks and maybe just look at a guy so they can see him, you know, kind of deal. Now they have to really focus in for those 3 weeks. And the purpose of that, obviously, was to try to get the players back into Portsmouth and get the players back into what will be back in Chicago again, but right now is the Orlando pre-draft camp. And so this is that first year. It's kind of been a feeling out process for all parties. The agents really didn't change too quickly. You know, no one's really moved, been overly reactionary. It's just kind of a wait and see. But our advantage is that we're going to go, we know all the trainers and all the agents for these players at Draft Express. So we're going to go travel around to the gyms that they're working out at. We're going to see a lot of five-on-five scrimmaging. We're going to see all the drill work these guys are doing. And basically, we'll get to see these players on a, you know, a basketball court live in a workout setting weeks before any NBA team gets a chance to do the same. So we're really, we feel very fortunate for that, and we're very thankful for the relationships we have. But that's kind of where we're at right now, is a lot of teams are just really focusing, and you heard Danny mention Synergy the other day when he was defending that completely ridiculous assertion from Ian Thompson that we didn't have an NBA scout. I just thought that was the most irresponsible thing that a major publication could publish. That's like saying, you know, I don't even know how to, you know, make a analogy to that. You know, it's just like saying you're driving blindfolded. I mean, you could do it, I guess, but no one really does. So we're just talking about Synergy. Synergy is, well, you're familiar with Synergy, Justin, but it's the video play typing system. This is what these guys are going to be doing until that three-week period of time, just watching endless film. They're going to be doing they can do interviews. They can do Q&A stuff. They can't do any basketball drill work, but they're just going to be studying their butts off after May 22nd once they know where they're kind of slotted, and that's it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Not about where they're slotted, but who's there. Inquiring minds in the pit want to know who. If maybe you could give us your top five, Eric. If you're the Celtics, what's your five person draft board look like? And going along with that, I'm not sure. I know you've been traveling, so I'm not sure if you were able to hear Danny's comments the day after the list of eligible players came out, but he listed 12 players we seem to believe there are 12 players that are all above 6'8", that are early entry players to the draft that are basically his top 12. So basically, what's your top five, and what are your thoughts about the players that are on that? Maybe some notable exceptions like Mike Conley.
Yeah, I'm not a huge, like, I think Mike Conley would be a fine NBA player, but I think he's a little bit overhyped. If their team hadn't gone to the finals, he's a mid-first-round pick, and that doesn't change any of his ability, but he has a lot of stuff to work on. He's not the fastest guy. He's not the biggest, although he has long arms. He can run a team. He's very heady, but he's not a phenomenal passer in terms of his vision. You know, he's not going to break off like the unbelievable stuff. I mean, he's nowhere near as good a passer as Rajon Rondo is in terms of court vision. You're talking about a very fundamental, very solid, you know, run the show kind of guy. I think he has kind of the court vision of, let's say, an Eric Snow. Now he's a better player, I think, than Eric Snow is. But this talk of the, you know, top five, top seven, I think that's just a lot of what he was able to accomplish in a big stage, which counts for something, but it's not a replacement for his actual skill set, which is solid and developing, but he's not like a Chris Paul, Deron Williams, you know, ready to lead his team into the playoffs second year kind of guy. So, I mean, that's just a quick thing that's a plug for us on Mike Conley, just because, like I said, again, not because we don't like him, but just because I think that people are starting to value him above some players that should have a substantially higher probability of being better players. Now, my top five, I mean, Oden and Durant kicked that off right away. We've had endless debates on air and off about who you would go with. I think you can make a case for either one. You're satisfied. Obviously, you don't need to get into that much stuff. I think Spencer Hawes is right up there on my list of players. I think as a center, he's got some phenomenal talent. You know, he might not be the defensive, like, stalwart guy that, you know, obviously that Oden is, and he's probably never going to be as good a defensive player as Al Horford or Joakim Noah, but when you talk about his overall skill set and his ability to play intelligent team defense, to be able to, you know, challenge players and to be basically have an all-star level of execution at the five, I think it's very hard to pass a guy up like that in favor of a yeoman, you know, kind of guy. And then, you know, moving on to Al Horford, I think that's, you know, kind of where I see him slightly out of the top five. I would go more, if I was filling in those last two, I'd be looking at someone that could really kind of explode. And I'd have to say, as much as I've been against it, and I got to confirm this when I see him, I'd be putting Yee probably, or be thinking about him at this stage in the game, in that five, because of his skill set and his size and his potential. And, you know, maybe Brandon Wright is, like, right in there as your reach guys. Because I just think that those two guys have substantially more potential than I think Noah or Horford. And potential isn't everything, and you got to go through the whole process. But just from a skill set standpoint, I'd rather reach for a guy that I think could, you know, that could transcend at his position and give you some leverage there instead of a guy that's solid. You know, Al Horford, I think we have enough pieces, you know, on the Celtics roster to make a move for a guy that essentially is Al Horford in the future. You know, I don't think it's that hard to find a guy like that. People are giving him a lot of credit as well. He is not a good low post player. Defensively, yes, he's a good defensive player. He's a great defensive player, and he can dribble and he can pass. But he's a face-up jump shot guy that drives in on the NBA level. He does not have quick feet on his offensive moves. And he's not overly creative on his offensive post moves, and he's not that tall. And even length-wise, he's long, but he's more shoulder breadth-wise. He's more shoulder instead of waist. So I think he'll have a much harder time holding his position on the block than a guy that might be a little more thick in his core. So I'd really go. I'd go. You know, Oden, Durant, Hawes, and Yee, and Brandon Wright right now with the full intention of not taking a couple of those guys and looking to move that position and try to get Pau Gasol or somebody like that, get a real front court guy that's ready to rock.
But one guy that you didn't mention, Eric, and the Eric that Danny mentioned pretty often, quite a bit the other day on WEEI when he was on the Big Show, he made a lot of comments that were very interesting. But one name that he brought up was Jeff Green. Now, I noticed over on Draft Express, you guys right now have Green at 15. From listening to Danny, if you believe what Danny says, which I'm not sure anybody should or does, but if you believe what Danny says, that Green's a top five guy, easy. What do you like about Green? Do you think he duplicates a lot of what's already in Boston right now? I'm thinking Ryan Gomes is somebody who, you know, does a lot of little things good, and Jeff Green seems to do that quite a bit, but he may be the next caliber above of what Gomes can do. That's my personal opinion, but what are your thoughts on Green?
Well, I think you nailed it. I think Jeff Green is another byproduct guy. He's a very solid player, but, I mean, to me, he looks like a clone of Ryan Gomes. It's just that he got to go to the Final Four and be, you know, and get all the adulation that you know, comes with it, and Ryan got, you know, busted out on a rather mediocre Providence team, and Jeff projects to a small forward much more, you know, right away. Like, there was no questions. Ryan slipped because he looked like an undersized four, and no one believed that he could play the three, and some people still don't believe he played three, although it's inherently obvious that he can and will. But I think Jeff Green is a very solid player. He's going to have a very long career, much like Ryan. He's going to have, you know, he's going to have very similar numbers. His draft position might afford him a higher slot in his team's hierarchy, which he'll seize. He won't fail. So he might end up averaging more points a game, but he'll get he might be given the third scorer role on a team or be allowed to be groomed into one. Kind of much like Josh Childress down in Atlanta is nowhere near as good as the opportunity he's been afforded to work through his, you know, solid but unspectacular game. I think Jeff's one of those cog in the wheel, like great player to have, starting caliber, you know, kind of glue guy that can really put up some numbers, you know, on the nights that your top tier guys are off, but he's never going to carry a franchise. And I think Danny, that's like the circle it and lock it down guy that he's talking up publicly to make other people pay more attention to him guy. There's no way in hell that he would take him in the top five.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're talking so highly about Spencer Hawes. I like everything that I've heard about him. I haven't seen him play, but there's a fellow on our message board, Ravi Singh, used to be the Celtics writer for Hoops World, and he lives out in Seattle, and he's gotten to see him quite a lot, and he's been raving about him since before Christmas. Thinks he's easily top five talent and potential all-star in the league. And I thought I'd mention also we have a fellow that writes to our board, Fabio Anderle. You might have read something he wrote on the Celtics blog. Fabio sent us a report, and he's never really liked Thiago Splitter, but he's been watching him in the European League playoffs, and he's one player that he doesn't like to see the Celtics get drafted. One of his favorite players is Bellinelli. And you didn't mention him when you mentioned the Euros earlier. How far up do you think he'll go, and do you think he could ever play point guard in this league?
I don't think he'll play point guard. I think he's a good, you know, a very solid rotation level, you know, guard or whatever role. I think he's versatile enough to play with some, you know, it depends on the personnel. Whether he's not a pure point in terms of, if that was the team's first option.
He's not a pure point, but I thought that part of his attraction would be that he was playing some point guard and showed some point guard skills as a very young player in the Italian league.
Oh, absolutely. The private workout process is really not good designed for a player with his skill. It's really just a physical showcase showdown where it's like, how high do you jump? You know, how powerful are you? You know, how many, I mean, you make shots and stuff like that, but private workouts are really a wow factor. I mean, I've sat there and watched with a number of scouts and just listening to the conversations they have. It just boggles my mind some of the things they focus on. I think there's a certain arrogance where they think that they can teach any player, you know, the game. Like that's like the easy part, so they tend to err on the side of grabbing the Uber athlete or the guy that, you know, has the more impressive raw skill set, and they're like, oh, all we have to do is teach him everything and he'll be the greatest. But not every scout, but I hear a lot of that kind of talk. It's like, well, he doesn't look like he runs real well, or he looks real smooth running the court. I'm like, what does that have to do with anything? But Bellinelli is a guy, I think, falls in that 20 to 30 range. I think that's pretty safe to say he'll go in that area. I don't think he'll go any higher than 20. I think he'll be a very solid pro, though. I hate to bring up the same analogies. When I look at a guy like him, I look at the guys that have had success. I don't know if he's as good as Ginobili, but I look at guys like Ginobili and guys like Calderon, Anthony Parker, although he's an American coming over here. You have these guys that are just so smart, and that they've trained so much better on basketball over in Europe that when they come in, it's not about like reining like a young, you know, pony in and say, okay, you know, calm down, you know, young fellow. These guys come in and they play basketball. You know, they don't overextend themselves. You know, they don't play recklessly. They come in and they apply their game to the common sense of winning games. And that's, I think, the biggest value for any of these European guys is you just have a lot of guys that start at a base level, they err on the side of playing smart basketball, and then they extend out their game and their capabilities as, you know, the situation, dictates. So I think Bellinelli will be a very solid player if he goes to the right place, or he'll sit on the bench and do nothing and go back to Europe if he goes to the wrong team. And it's as simple as that.
Yeah, Don Nelson has been applauded by his Lithuanian point guard, whose name I won't even try to butcher.
Sarunas Jasikevich, right? Jasikevich?
Yeah, who said that Nelson was as much of a Euro-style coach, except almost as much as D'Antoni. and that he was applauding it and saying it was a big part of their success this year.
Yeah, that's a guy that Yastikevich is a perfect example of what's wrong with American basketball. I mean, it's partly Yastikevich's fault. He could have gone to Cleveland, and Big Z tried to, you know, that's his best friend or whatever, tried to convince him to go down there, but he signed with Indiana, you know, for whatever reason. But Yastikevich just could have been a damn solid starting caliber, you know, guard in this league. He's not a good defensive player. Everyone already knew that, but he is an amazing shooter. He's a lights-out playmaker, you know, passing the ball, and he's fearless. And he went to a bad situation where the general manager and the coach were completely not on the same page, which is a little, you know, embarrassing considering how close-knit that, you know, Donnie Walsh, Larry Bird, Rick Carlisle triumvirate was. But, you know, Rick never let him play because, A, he wasn't good enough defensively, and, B, Rick was a super control-oriented coach, and Yastikevich is a control-oriented point guard. The same stuff you've been reading about with Baron Davis and how he was considered a poison pill down and whatever, but Don's let him play. That's as easy as it gets in an explanation, saying one guy, you know, one coach, a control-oriented coach like Byron Scott, you know, puts the reins on the guy and wants guys to run, you know, every set like just so, and they really take away a lot of that creative freedom. And then you get a guy like Don Nelson, who you can criticize him about a bunch of other things, but he takes a guy like Baron Davis and he says, listen, Baron might have some flaws, but at the end of the day, if I let him do what he does best, it's going to be a hell of a lot better for us than if I sit there and try to, you know, nitpick all the little things he doesn't do. If I give him some freedom, then I'll get a little, you know, control back in return. And a player like Yastikevich just can't get on the court because they got Monta Ellis and Baron Davis, which is completely fine, but now he's going to go back to Europe before he gets too old, and you're talking about a guy that could have had a pretty solid impact on an NBA team and showed signs of it when he did get a chance to play in Indiana and is now going to go home. And
he was quoted as saying he's going to sign with another NBA team.
Oh, he is? He changed his mind?
Well, that's what I saw no more than 3 days ago. And I believe it was in the same article where he was praising Nelson.
That would be tremendous. He'd be a great pickup. And I think Walter
Herman,
free. Too.
He's a free agent. Yeah. Right now, so he's going to try anyway. We'll see. Obviously, if he gets lowballed, maybe he does go back.
Well, even if he gets lowballed, NBA lowballing is top shelf in the EuroLeague. So
could he not make $4 or $5 million easily over in Europe though?
No, I don't think so. I mean, cumulatively, but annually, no.
No,
mm-hmm.
I thought he was making something like that before he came over. $4 million,
maybe. Maybe with endorsements and stuff like that, they tend to frame the money a little differently, how they list out their salaries. But I don't think from the club, I don't think anybody makes $4 million, $5 million a year as a contract player annually.
Maybe I'm wrong. I know that. I think that's what he held out for here, wasn't it? About $5
million? Oh, out here? No, he signed for like 3.8 or 3.6 or something like that anyway. He didn't have a huge contract. It was all about the situation, and he completely missed and went to the wrong team.
Yeah, maybe I got it all wrong then. I thought he commanded more money than that, and I thought that's the Celtics were interested and passed on him, I thought, because, you know, they thought he wanted too much.
No, I think he just was, he was interested in a more stable situation, and I can't blame the guy at coming over at 29. Years old, you know, he was looking to come into a situation where he not only get playing time, which he could have done here, but also be on a team that was going to be in the playoffs so he could establish himself. I think you can't blame a guy at that stage in his career for maybe not taking the money or maybe requiring more money to take a leap of faith in that situation. But I'm just happy that he's going to stay in the league if he does. If he gets an opportunity, he can play. And as I say, Walter Herman, another one of those Argentinian guys, same with Luis Scola, who hopefully is in the NBA next year. You know, those guys can play. Walter Herman was a phenomenal player, was much more highly regarded. Asked Fabio about where Walter Herman's stock was maybe 4 or 5 years ago before a series of unfortunate personal events really culled away a lot of the fire that he played with. But, you know, 6'8", 6'9", 235-pound flashing, you know, forward. I thought that guy would have been nailed in the NBA, a lot like Gerald Wallace, like that kind of build. He was the European Slam Dunk Championship champion, whatever that means. But, I mean, just a smart player. He was athletic for a European. He was athletic for an NBA player, for that matter. And he didn't get the time of day. He got brought over here, And then at the end of the year, he got put in, and he puts up, like, you know, 15 straight, like, you know, 16, 18-point games, hitting threes left and right. Spanoulis from the Greek team last year, you know, Houston signed him and promptly sat him on the bench for the rest of his life. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. When, you know, you don't like something about a guy and it's going to preclude them from getting on the court, don't sign him because they can play. Just obviously not in the systems that they got picked with.
Yeah, there's several others, but I got to let John jump in. He's been itching to get some question in. Go ahead, John.
Hello? Is this thing on? Hello? Hello? Oh. yeah, where's Roman Wolkowitzki when you needed him, you know? Where's the old redhead? That's what I'm wondering. Hey, I wanted to get to the back to the draft a little bit, and I wanted to talk about some guys here and kind of give me like a quick hits on them. We haven't talked about a lot about them, but the first one I want to talk about is a guy that there's some talk that he may not stay in the draft, along with Jeff Green, and that's Roy Hibbert. What's your quick take on Roy Hibbert? I'm going to give you a list of these guys. So,
quick take, Roy Hibbert, starting caliber center eventually from his progress. Not anything, he's not going to blow off doors. I think his top level is probably like Jamal McGlure when he was at the top of his game, you know, maybe 13 points, you know, 10 rebound guy at the peak of his game. I hope both those guys go back, though, because they have a sick guard tandem coming in next year, and Georgetown is my hands-on favorite to win the whole thing next year if those two guys come back. But yeah, Hibbert, good player.
Okay. How about Julian Wright?
Oh, Julian Wright is as good as he wants to. He's the second coming of Lamar Odom, in my opinion. I mean, as soon as he figures out how to shoot, you know, he's not a good shooter, but he doesn't have a lot of fundamental flaws that will preclude him from ever hitting shots. He's the second coming of Lamar Odom. That's what I think he is.
And last but not least, a guy who a lot of people are drooling over, but I'm not sure where he would play in Boston, Corey Brewer.
Great defensive player, super long at 6'9". He will be a lights-out shooter. Right now he's a streak shooter, has no handles whatsoever, so he can't create his own shot. But if you run him off of screens and he keeps on practicing that skill, he should be a big-time pop shot guy. I think he can have like a Coutinho Mobley level prime. I think that's where he's at with a great defensive ability at his size.
All right, well, let's go to I got an email question from Lance G, and he asks, what type of Celtics team will compete better against the current Nets and Raptors teams? A fast break pass oriented team with Rondo and Telfair, or a slow down dump it in the post team with West and Jefferson? Have a great show, guys. Lance. You know, obviously he's looking at, you know, trying to win this division, and you know, so not necessarily what's going to win outside of the division, but for this one.
Well, I'll put it back on the Raps guys again, since we all lost that bet. I guess there should have been some qualification for injury time. But if we're healthy, we win the division. I don't care about what all the people, we would have sucked anyways, and all this other stuff. You can sit there and extrapolate stats and have arguments all day long. This division is not great. We have a low post presence that none of the other teams do. Chris Bosch is not a low post presence, and since his team got spanked in the playoffs, you can see exactly how not a low post presence he was against a team that has absolutely no interior game in New Jersey. And New Jersey is going to be completely disassembled next year, and the Raptors will be better, but the Celtics are inevitably going to make some moves, are going to add a better player than anybody Toronto's adding, and with health to our top two guys and, you know, and health for the rest of those guys, it doesn't take much. I mean, yeah, you dump it in the post. It's not a pure slow it down, grind it out, use all 24 seconds of the shot clock. I think we're going to run opportunistically. I think they're going to go into motion as at every opportunity they can, but they're going to err on the side of not turning the ball over. And, you know, inevitably you end up playing, you know, as much of a transition team as Phoenix is. I mean, what are they, 60-40 half court to, you know, to transition early opportunity, you know, secondary break and all that other stuff. Teams don't play transition a majority of their possessions, even the best transition teams. You're going to play more in the low post or in the half court. And if you have a motion half court set where the ball moves and people move, that's how the Sacramento Kings played. That was not necessarily a transition-oriented team. That was a motion half court team. And if we play like that and we play off of Al Jefferson, the way his passing improved and his ability to read doubles, I think that that's good enough to play. So I think we're fine playing. We will play a half court, a predominantly half court game, because you have Jefferson, and who's really going to stop him, especially when he comes back with an extra 10 or 12 pounds of strength, you know, added to that frame. So I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
All right, Eric. Well, before we wrap the show and, you know, close it out here, I wanted to talk to you and give you a chance to talk a little bit about some very intriguing stuff that you're doing with BBIQ. It's kind of, I think the company's slogan is taking the guesswork out of guaranteed contracts. We've only got a couple of minutes, but can you hit the highlights of what the company does? And just, I mean, we're talking about taking basketball analytics to a very deep level.
Yeah. We went through a lot of permutations of that slogan. Really, we measure the intangibles of the game, which is we do behavioral and personality assessment, and we build it into the construct. We add it as variables, this assessment tool that we use, into a database that tracks just a number of variables, and we go all the way down from just regular statistical analytics into the synergy stuff that Danny was talking about. So we go down to play typing. So we have basically it's cause and effect. We gauge player aptitudes based off behavioral characteristics. We basically categorize it into intangible categories like work ethic and leadership and mental toughness and all these other things, which you actually can quantify to a significant degree. It's certainly a hell of a lot more significant than the stick your thumb in the air degree that goes on right now. And we're building a front-end dashboard where basically teams can log on as a resource and they can watch all international, all professional, all collegiate basketball. And we're building out profiles for the high school and collegiate guys so they can put together portfolios of their own work for themselves, kind of like I'd say make it analogous to Facebook, but it's completely professional and resume-oriented and not like friend oriented, and then we process a lot of this data, and we provide reports to the teams and to the agents and to the players themselves if they want it. So it's pretty encompassing. If you look at, you know, www.bbiq.com, I never thought I'd ever be in a position to plug myself on anything, but there's just a lot of material there, and it's not too familiar with any to anybody right now, but I think it's going to really take off in the next 2 to 3 years. I think it's going to be a standard for player development in the NBA.
Well, we know that the Celtics team hired Nid Nagel. So the brain doctor, right, John? Thank you, the brain doctor. And I think for some people who do have any kind of a psych background, I think he took the Myers-Briggs and kind of applied it to basketball players, personalities, and trying to find ways to apply it to how they would fit into a role on the team. So basically what you're saying is you guys do an extensive amount of testing with the players. Do they, answer questionnaires and stuff like that? Is it kind of a lengthy testing process to figure out, exactly? Because that's really one of the major advantages to the services that you guys do, is it's really talking about how to build a team with a team concept and taking into account, how players' personality types, I guess, for lack of a better word, fit into the team concept so that you can get balance.
Yeah, we're absolutely not taking the Myers-Briggs, to be clear, and we also assess. And my father, Dr. David Weiss, has been a clinical psychologist for 30 years. Nid Nagel is not a practicing physician. And basically, this came out of, This was all born out of the fruits of the love that I have for the game, and then a conversation during the first Vegas Summer League watching the Celtics talking about the things that couldn't be measured. And, and me and my father started getting talking. He's like, oh, you can measure a lot of this stuff. And we started discussing what he did professionally, probably one of the first times we've had a discussion like that in my life. And we really got into some of the nitty-gritty details of what behavioral assessment material can do. You need feedback from the players. They have to participate. Nid Nagel does it by sight, I guess, apparently. He doesn't even assess anybody. But Myers-Briggs itself has a lot of inherent flaws. It's not considered a scientifically valid process. But in terms of reliability, you don't make decisions off of personnel decisions. But it's very interesting. There's a lot of stuff on the website that I took about a year for me to write all that stuff, so it's hard to put it in the synopsis. But there's just a lot of capability to really put some actionable information. That's the thing that's been missing. Caliper got a lot of hype. I think if people remember the ESPN article about Bargnani a couple months ago, they referenced Caliper's recommendation to do this. Caliper's the world's largest basically HR behavioral personality assessment company, but they do just a really cursory, you know, kind of generic personality assessment that gives, you know, very legitimate information, but it's not sports specific. It's not basketball specific, and it really doesn't incorporate the other elements of the game. What we strive to do is not isolate psychology as kind of the answer, but we're really using it as a piece of the answer, and we're incorporating the traditional scouting methodology, the basketball analytics statistically, and then the film study. And we're really trying to take all the different elements of professional basketball scouting and put it into one succinct database and query tool and search engine, basically, so teams can log on and they can basically ask us about anything and put out some very meaningful findings based off that information.
Excellent. Well, Eric, thanks for coming on the show, and we're definitely looking forward to the lottery night and having a better idea of maybe having some real concrete discussions about what's going to happen over the summer months and leading up into training camp next October. So looking forward to that, and glad we're going to have you on.
Thank you very much, guys. It's always a pleasure, and let's keep our fingers crossed for May 22nd.
Yeah.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Eric.
And enjoy your vacation. It's well-deserved. I know how busy you've been.
Thank you very much, and I will right now. I've got the champagne bubbling.
Excellent. Have a good night, man.
Good night.
Thanks, Eric. So we're wrapping up the show here. I can see the Sopranos diehards dropping out of the pit as we speak.
I haven't left yet, so.
Right. That's because you know how to use a DVR.
That's right.
We got next week, John.
You, come on. Come on.
It's like a faint voice in the background. Yeah. I can barely hear JB.
Talk about his actions against New Jersey 2 years ago.
It's three weeks. I didn't want you to forget.
I know. I would feel hurt and embarrassed if I didn't have that. So thank goodness we had you were able to bring me back to the point. No, we've got 2 weeks to go. We're going to continue the march towards the draft. I talked with Steve Bolpet. He's going to come on here in the next couple weeks. If we can tear him away from some of his other duties in the hat. He's got, you know, so we're going to have Steve on. We've got some others that are in the pipeline to come, but we don't have them marked down for dates yet. So yeah, we're going to keep plugging the draft talk. I think people want to talk draft. They want to talk playoffs. They want to talk trades and looking at the guys who aren't playing well. I've seen more let's trade, you know, trade number one for Dirk Nowitzki trade threads than I have seen in my whole life in the last couple of days. So you're going to see that over the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So, you know, I think we'll just keep plugging away at that, guys, and, you know, keep...
Tell us about the ping pong ball show.
Ping pong ball show. Well, the night of the 22nd, obviously, is a couple of you may or may not be aware, is the night of the NBA draft lottery. We're going to have a show during that night. How long we're going to go, I think, probably will depend upon how long we're able to put it together. But we are going to have a show that night. We will be live. So we want you all to call in to commiserate or to join the celebration. We're hoping it's the latter and not the former. And we'll have some guests on. And Jamie?
When is the league going to announce it? Is it at the halftime of a playoff game? Has it been announced yet? No.
The new tradition is to have it at a separate time. They want to make it a bigger spectacle. They have not yet taken Jughead's suggestion.
Yeah,
to,
a bigger spectacle by what? Giving it its own night? That doesn't.
No. You want to have like one of those tiny microscopic cameras inside the drum. I think is what you're looking for.
No, I want to go bottom to top. I mean, the top to the bottom. I want to see the ping pong balls bouncing around. I want them.
I know.
I know. Bigger spectacle. Right. I can't wait to tear this apart. We're going to have fun that night. I'll tell you that much.
Let's not
Do we know what time it's on?
I believe it's 8:30, but I'm gonna have to double check on that. That's the last time I've seen it was listed at. So, we'll plug the heck out of it in the next couple weeks, and I'm sure our good friend Jeff over at Celtics Blog, over in the pit, yeah, will be sure to put something up on this blog talking about we'll be having a big show that night. We're certainly, we want to have as many people in there. We want people to chime in and give their thoughts, because we're just trying to fill air, guys. Until we get that, we know where we are. We're going to try to do the best we can to try to make it all interesting. But as you guys know, until we know what that pick is, there's a lot to be determined. And I also should note that we didn't mention, over on FSN New England, they have some thoughts that from their guys that from the Celtics that they're kind of doing little video clips or audio clips or blogs, and I got to watch Tommy Heinsohn, thanks to Shirley putting some of the headlines there on Celtics blog, Tommy's thoughts on the draft, and it's about 6 minutes. It's not too long. But if you have a broadband connection, I urge you to go over there and check it out. It's kind of interesting to hear Tommy's thoughts on it. He's, I haven't had a lot of time to see what a lot of these guys, but obviously, he knows more basketball in his in a clipping off his pinky nail than I know my whole body. So it's good stuff over there. So I urge you to, maybe a place not a lot of people are checking out right now, but you should get over there and check it out. It's good stuff.
Well, all right, guys. I think we're pretty much wrapping up the show. But wow, John, you just fit in like 45 minutes worth of information into 2 minutes. That was excellent.
We'll have to play it back in super slow mo so that way everyone can understand what I was saying. But
Well, I think you hit all the high points, and so on to next week. Hopefully, it'll be. Hopefully, Bull Pet will be on here in the next couple of weeks. I'm looking forward to that. He's excellent. He's going to be a really great guest, so stay tuned for that. And, the lottery show, we'll start to put together a list of people and start to plug it. So looking forward to it, guys. I guess it's time to say good night.
Yeah, thank you all for listening.
Out.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart.
Baby, let me be.
Unchain my heart,
'cause you don't care about me. You got me sort of like a pillowcase, but you let my love go to waste. So unchain my heart, oh please, please set me free.